Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood. With me tonight is my co-host, as always,
Chad Metz.
Yes, we still do exist, and yes, this podcast is still a thing. Life has been somewhat busy for the both of us over the last couple of weeks, and finding time to get this done has been kind of a adventure.
Yeah.
But we finally did manage to nail down each other in the same place and time in the space-time continuum. So, Chad, we're in the month of September. Do you know what that means?
Right this second, there's a festival going on. Other than that, no.
We're coming closer to the month of October. And you know what happens in the month of October?
What happens in October?
We get the greatest superhero movie ever made.
I don't appreciate anything about that setup. Nothing at all. Again, screw that movie. I'm upset that it's, like, as being one of the most highly anticipated movies and is projected to make all this money. Why? Why?
Tell us why, Chad. Because Avi's got such a great track record, and you know, Tom Hardy does really weird voices that people seem to love and
that they can't understand.
The movie looks like it's from 1998. So what's not to love, Chad?
I mean, everything you just said. So, I'd already prepared myself for this movie to make a little bit of money because there's literally nothing coming else coming out.
Comes in on the same day as A Star Is Born.
But
does not share any audience, and it's kind of one of those things where we know that Venom has a fan base.
Yes.
And so people will be desperate to see Venom on the big screen in whatever incarnation, and they will go. The issue is, how good is the movie going to be, and can it sustain legs, and that kind of a thing.
But the excitement for, like, Venom has enough of a following, it's connected to enough things, and yeah, while Star Is Born is coming out, yeah, movie nerds are going to go see that, but this will be one of those weekends to show you that the vibe between, like, movie nerds and people that like popular movies. Because I would love for A Star Is Born to, like, dwarf Venom and beat it out. I don't think that's going to happen. And, like, enough excitement for Venom is enough to get you a big pop that opening weekend. But then I want it to, like ember in the wind, just, like, flicker and then die off and then go away. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen. And then I'm going to be bad, because that means these suckers are going to be like, oh, we did the right thing. Let's keep making stupid movies. And while Venom will work, Morbius is not. I don't care what... Look, Venom can come up here and rake in, like, for that movie, oh...
$300 million domestic.
Whoa. See, that's a bridge too far. I was going to say, like, you know, $500 million worldwide and, like, $250-ish domestic. If it makes $300 million domestic, yes. We're locked in as hell that we're going to get another Venom movie, but then it'll be like Fast Track Morbius. And Morbius is going to come out, and much like the conversation we had before, on the face. Just flat on the face. There's nothing attractive about Morbius. People that like Spider-Man forget that Morbius is even a part of it. Nothing's going to happen. They're like, Jared Leto is in it, and he's not the most popular fellow around these parts. Nothing good is going to come out of it, but we're going to be stuck waiting for that crap. So this movie just needs to come and go. That's what needs to happen. But I don't know why we're going to be stuck with this.
Because Mr. Hardy wants to fight Mr. Holland, and he's so looking forward to it.
I don't care. I do not... There is a world in which I would care. That world happens when we've had the Spider-Man, the Marvel proper Spider-Man 3 sequel, in which we set up with Venom, and then Mr. Hardy shows up as Eddie Brock, and 4 as Venom. And in that world, I'm very excited. This particular universe we're living in, I want no part in that, because this Venom is just this thing that shows up and attaches himself to Eddie Brock and then talks in voices that we can't understand about turds and wind. I don't want no part of this world.
Amy Pascal is a very happy woman this week. She's finally getting her redemption. The federal government has announced that they will indeed be pressing charges against North Korea for the Sony hack, something that, although the Obama administration talked very sternly about the hack and condemned the attack very forcefully, they did not make a move to prosecute, mainly because it's sort of silly to prosecute countries where and individuals who are never going to be extradited to your country. So it's really just the theatricality of it. But she's got to be very pleased that, you know, that has happened. She's lead dog on this. And, you know, she's finding interesting ways to talk about it. And there has not been a set visit. There has not been an EW spread. It got thrown in there together with all the Comic-Con preview they were doing, but it hasn't had its own spread. No real set visit. Low-key, still not clear on what the rating's going to be. Is it PG-13? Mm-hmm. Is it R? Your director's having conflicting comments because he was saying, at Comic-Con, it's an R-rated movie, and then 2 weeks later, you're putting out to people that it's a PG-13 because you want to mess them up with Spider-Man. Well, you know, just because he starts at an R-rated level doesn't mean you can't bring him down to a PG-13 mm-hmm. level for a, you know, a team-up movie of whatever kind. I think the trouble here is the same trouble we've all had with this concept. Like, if you know the background to all of this, you understand that Avi loves the character. You understand that Sony loves the character. You understand that Sony looks at Venom and, with the success of Deadpool, sees what could be their Deadpool. The problem is, he is the singular character out of the 4,000 characters that they have the rights to that is solely dependent on a Spider-Man. And you're not going to put any other variation, Miles Morales or anybody else, in that costume. And you're not going to do a CGI Spider-Man because that would just throw everything off and confuse people, especially if he doesn't talk. So you're going to try and make a movie with Spider-Man's arch nemesis of the 90s without Spider-Man. You're going to use a similar variation of the origin story. The symbiote's going to come down, crashing down into a meteor site. A corporation's going to get a hold to the remains of the meteorite. They're going to discover the symbiotes. A guy's going to become obsessed with the symbiote and what it can do for human evolution. He's going to start experimenting on people, attaching symbiotes to people. And then Eddie Brock's going to find out about that, investigate as an Alex Jones-type InfoWars guy. And then, you know, one thing's going to lead to another. He's going to get the Venom's symbiote's going to attach to Eddie Brock, and we'll get this whole deal. But there's not going to be, like, even if you set up Carnage in this film, Carnage's relationship to Venom is not the same as Spider-Man's relationship to Venom.
Yeah.
And the modus operandi for Venom existing doesn't exist in this timeline. I mean, he's just a symbiote that just wants to attach to somebody for whatever reason. He doesn't really have a world-ending goal. He doesn't even have a protecting the Earth goal. He just needs a host. And so he fuses himself to this guy. And, you know, this guy kind of talks him into, if we're going to do this, we're only going to hurt bad people. And so you get some kind of weird anti-hero type thing, a majig. But none of it is in keeping with the spirit of what that character is and why that character works. So I think for all of us, the question that we have is the same question we've had since they announced this movie 2 years ago, since they started filming on it a year ago. How do you make a Venom movie work with no Spider-Man? And I don't think Avi, I don't think Patel, I don't think that Pascal, I don't think any of the Sony brass have a firm conclusion on how to do that. Now look, this can completely be one of those situations where the marketing is, you know, totally off and we get a completely different movie and we all love it. But I submit to you as evidence that these are the same people who launched a marketing campaign for the Ghostbusters reboot in the midst of a just barrage of, you know, internet hatred, and put out a crappy trailer in March for a movie that came out in June. And that was like, and they put another one out in May and had this really truncated publicity process. that didn't make the film look any good. So it's not like their marketing department has this huge long track record of enormous success. It's not like the guy who ran the Deadpool campaign is running the Venom campaign. So, you know, I have the same issue. How do you make a Venom movie work without Spider-Man? And I don't trust these people to do it.
I know what their idea is. Their idea is that, you know, after in the early 90s, Venom went off and he became the anti-hero. And they're like, okay, we can just start him from here. Which we'll see how successful they are with that. But again, you pointed to it. The basic foundation of Venom is that these two characters don't like Peter Parker. They found each other and became this one character that hates Peter Parker, and his whole driving force is, I'm going to kill Peter Parker. I'm not going to mess with anybody else. I might stop other people that do bad stuff around it, but I'm going to kill him. And that's his whole motivation. He does change over time, but he still hates Peter. So, you know, starting off without that, it's kind of like it's not the same character.
And you can't make him hate Carnage.
No, he does, but it's like a different kind of hate. Like, Peter is like a
sperm lover.
Yeah, the symbiote is like a sperm lover. Eddie is just complete rage because he's done terrible things and he's placing all of his hatred on Spider-Man instead of on himself. With Carnage, it's just like, this thing came from me and it's doing all this stuff and I can't get down with that. So that's my problem with him. So it's a whole completely different thing. But they're going to try to play this like, their ultimate goal, as far as I've heard, is that they want this movie to be successful, and pretty much all of the Spider-Man properties that they want to make from here on out, they're going to replace Spider-Man with Venom, which is stupid. But this is where we're at.
I'm thinking, and this may be just foolish on my part, I'm thinking that they wanted to do the Sinister Six, and I think Marvel took that idea. I think Marvel's trying to set up for Spider-Man 3 a version of the Sinister Six. And, you know, obviously Drew Goddard can't be a part of that anymore, being that, you know, he's getting ready to go do X-Force, as far as we understand. I mean, everything could be up in the air now with the sale, you know, finalizing in another 13 months. But, you know, if you were going to do this, Sinister Six would be the way to go. And you could put together the group of villains, and they could each have their own standalone movie, and then you could bring them together to fight a greater foe, whatever that greater foe ended up being. You could even have set it up to where you could use some of the lesser-known, some of the more well-known characters to be part of the Six, and then have them take on Venom, if you wanted to go that route. But that's not what they're doing. And so I think what they've come to the conclusion of is, well, we still want to do villains, anti-hero standalone movies, but we don't have a goal. We don't have a place to get to. Like, it's not like we're going to have Eddie Brock showing up at the tail end of the credits for a Black Cat movie, recruiting her to go be a part of the new Sinister Six or the new anti-hero team that's going to take out whatever. What is the point of having Black Cat, Silver Sable, Morbius, Venom? What's the point of having those guys have their own movie except to make Sony money? They're not going to... If you bind them together, what are they going to do? I mean, it's... You know, the Defenders put together some really great... Like, Netflix put together some really great individual series. When it came time to do the Defenders, they fell flat on their face. Because ultimately the threat of the Hand was not set up well enough, and so you ended up having that whole thing fall on its face. And everything coming out of it's going to be good. From all indications, Iron Fist 2 is better than Iron Fist 1. We know Daredevil will be awesome. We know Jessica Jones will be awesome. And Luke Cage will be awesome. Those individual series have been really strong indie contenders. That's how strong they've been. The issue is that team-up was not very strong. But Perlmutter had a goal that they were working to from the beginning when they announced everything. They were working toward the Defenders. What's Sony going to work to? What is, even if in this grand vision, a Venom movie makes $700 million worldwide, and you've got a super hit on your hands, and you fast-track Morbius, and you fast-track Black Panther, Black Cat, and Silver Sable, to what end? Just to have more franchises that can make you more money? I mean, what are you going to do with those franchises?
Sony is franchise starved, so I think that end goal is to have more franchises. Just like, you know, Black Cat and Silver Sable were supposed to be in a movie together, and they have since broken it apart and started off from scratch, which when they announced this, I told you, like, this is never going to see the light of day, and I'm mad because they're putting all these good people around it, and they're going to just not do it. And here we are. But yeah, Jumanji is their franchise. I think it's their only franchise right now, because everything else is fell flat on its face. They're trying to get Men in Black back up and running, and from all intents and purposes, that looks like it might work. But, I mean, I think working with Disney and seeing, I mean, Disney is just a franchise monster, and it's like, well, why can't we have that? We got all this stuff. Let's do something with this stuff to have that. But having all of the Spider-Man characters is all well and good. Most of them need... They don't depend on Spider-Man like Venom does, but they... That's the whole thing about it.
Ask Fox. Ask Fox how hard it is to have characters who should naturally work in independent franchises, and how hard it is to make that happen.
Fantastic Four.
Or even X-Men.
Yeah.
I mean, getting that first X-Men movie off the ground in 2000 was not the easiest thing in the world. In a landscape that was far different from here, but still. Like, not all those films have worked, as we well know. So, and this is your reminder, Chad, there is a Dark Phoenix movie that is done and in the can and sitting on a shelf somewhere, waiting to be exposed to the world so that Simon Kinberg can get his Academy Award for Best Director.
Not in the can right now, because... I'm pretty sure, like, right as we speak, they're doing reshoots right now. I don't think it's as extensive as was reported before, but they should be doing reshoots somewhere from now, like, the next couple months, so they can release this movie in February.
So they can continue to tinker with it, so they continue to water down the product, like Shane Black's Predator, which is getting killed right now?
Yeah, well, that has its own problems.
It's stupid. What happened essentially there, if what the critics are who've seen the film, if what they're saying is true, then basically Shane Black was given money after Iron Man 3 and went and made a Shane Black film in The Nice Guys, which was really great and really awesome, but you put it in the Memorial Day weekend corridor, it got killed, it wasn't promoted very well, no one went to see it, and it lost money. And so now you give him this huge franchise thing in The Predator, and he has this really awesome, really wry script, but you're freaked out because if you have too much of Shane Black's voice, you're afraid of what happened to The Nice Guys. And so you try and rein him in a little bit. Well, the problem is when you try and rein him in a little bit and tinker with his stuff, it doesn't work as well. And so you end up getting a product that is way worse than if you'd have just let him do his thing and have his movie. It's not like the Predator movies have made a boatload of money anyway in the last 30 years.
No.
So, I mean, for me, I can understand where they're coming from, but still, if you're going to let Ridley go off and, you know, overanalyze his Alien movies, giving Shane Black one Predator movie and letting him do his thing and having it just be his movie, I mean, you let Rob Zombie do that with the freaking Halloween franchise. I mean, let them do their thing.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't even talking about the reception, because I hadn't heard anything about the reception of that. Everything I've heard about Predator has all revolves around Olivia Munn and that dude that was the sexual predator felon dude that was in the movie that they cut from the movie, and how I know that she was by herself taking questions on the presser up at the festival about that, and nobody else was, and nobody else had even said anything about it. So Twitter's been a fire of that, and how this whole thing has been handled. At this point, the only person that has said anything about it other than her via anything has been Sterling K. Brown. And that's because when all this came out and it was and they started blasting all the dudes, he was like, hold up, I'm not even there. If I was there, I'd try to do something with you. And this has been, and he gave all this more eloquent response than I'm possible of giving right now. But that's been it. And I think that's buried me even seeing anything about the reception to the movie. So yeah, Predator's got a whole bunch of stuff going on now, and this Friday will be interesting.
I mean, the thing with Sony is, yes, their franchise starved, but the lesson to learn from DC, the lesson to learn from Transformers, the lesson to learn from the freaking, you know, Dark Universe, is that you have to have a clearly defined plan, and you have to have a clearly defined endpoint, and you have to worry about each individual film. You know, when Feige and Favreau and you know, Downey were sitting in a tent writing the movie at Iron Man 1 as they went, there was no intention of, oh, we're going to make 19 more of these, and we're going to make $2.4 billion, and everything's going to be great, and we're going to be the toast of the town. It was, we're going to make a good Iron Man movie. We're doing this Hulk movie over here. God knows what's going to happen with it, but we're going to do it, and we'll see where we stand after that. They slip the post-credit stinger at the end of Iron Man in, you know, just to test and see how it would react and how it would work, just in case, and the rest, is they know, as we know, is history. But even then, Feige and his team were like, we're pot committed. These are our movies. We are going to do a sequel to Iron Man. We're going to give Thor and Captain America their own movies. And we're going to do an Avengers movie. And if anything along this line fails, we're screwed. But this is where we're headed. And we're going to layer in all the necessary pieces, sometimes to our own detriment, to an Avengers movie. And we'll roll the dice on that and see how that turns out. Again, even when you had the amazing Spider-Man universe, say what you want to about Amazing Spider-Man 2 being overburdened, at least you know that Mark Webb and Avi and the Sony brass are pointing to a Sinister Six movie. You know that you've got, you know, both the Osborns, father and son there. You know that you've got the, you know, the vulture wings, and you know that you've got the, you know, apparatus for Dr. Octopus, and you know that Peter's found out the truth about his parents now, and that his parents were trying to stop Norman and all of this. There's a setup and there's a clear path from an Amazing Spider-Man 2 to an Amazing Spider-Man 3 to a Sinister Six movie. There's no clear path with what Sony's doing now. It's, well, we can make Venom a franchise, and if Venom works, then we can rush out of Venom 2, and we can start work on this Morbius movie, and then we can split up these Black Hat and Silver Sable movies to capitalize on the audiences that those would bring, and then we have, where we had no franchises outside of Spider-Man, we now have 4 franchises outside of Spider-Man, and we make all the money. Yay, us.
Yeah. That works in theory. They don't know what a theory is.
Right. So speaking of Marvel, we got a Captain Marvel set visit. I learned absolutely nothing from this set visit. I'm glad that they posted some very nice pictures. I'm ready for the first footage, which should be released sometime in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Ready to see a trailer, ready to lay eyes on this kind of thing. Seeing Brie Larson in a Nine Inch Nails t-shirt mm-hmm. and a ball cap does not do anything for me. I'm sorry. The idea of a Nick Fury who is, you know, literally just a desk jockey at S.H.I.E.L.D. and not the director is a very interesting place to put him, especially considering you're doing this movie in the 90s and, you know, they're never really specific about Robert Redford's character and Sam Jackson's character and when they were working together in that embassy and when they had this relationship that led to, you know, Nick becoming the director. But did you learn anything new? Because I didn't learn anything new. I pretty much figured this was the route we were going to go. The only thing that I found any interesting was, we're not going to make an origin story.
That was my point.
Because, like, you're going to do an origin story. You're just not going to do it in the traditional way. She's not going to start as an Air Force colonel and then get swept up by an alien spacecraft and then, you know, put to the through the Kree dust to see whether or not she... the Kree mist to see whether or not she's actually Kree. We're not going to see all of that. Or at least we're not going to start there.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is she's going to have to go back to Earth and she's going to figure out all of this stuff. And part of all of this stuff is going to be remembering how she came to leave Earth in the first place. How she came to get these powers. How she came to be a part of this super team. That's about the only thing that, like, yeah, okay, you're not going to do an origin story, but you're not going to do an origin story in the traditional way.
Yeah. Yeah, my whole thing was that she's going to start off with the powers, so... yeah, but everything else, I mean, it was nice to see, like, get a look at the Kree. I mean, not the Kree, the Skrulls. You know, actually seeing her in the suit. And then seeing most of the other players involved. But yeah, there was nothing, like, earth-shattering in that. The only other thing that's that's a little bit more than mild, is that, I cannot remember her name, but... her friend that's
got the daughter and
yeah, they got the daughter and her code name on her plane is Photon. God, I'm gonna be mad that I can't remember her name, but she is Maria Lambeau, I think that's in it. Yeah, Maria Lambeau. Because we knew that they had DeWanda Wise that's in. She's got to have the TV series. She was originally cast. She had to drop out, and they got. I don't know her name, but she's playing Maria. She's playing Maria. And the fact that they alluded to her daughter means that her daughter can be Monica, who is Photon and a Captain Marvel. I think a Captain Marvel at one point. So, since we know this one takes place in the 90s, that leaves that open when we get to possible sequels in the future to have Monica involved with Carol down the road. Other than that, no, it was just nice to see images. Now, I think last time we talked about it, I said I didn't really care about this movie because so far away, I know it's coming. I know I get excited. This started to pique the interest, and by the time we get the trailer, I'll be fully on board as I always am with these movies. It's just, we have to wait until we get all this stuff.
Not too much different from Cassie Lang.
Yeah.
I mean, you can use that down the road if you so choose. But... yeah, man. I mean, it's great to see Ronan the Accuser back up and running. It's nice to see Korath, doing his thing. But we're gonna get to learn about Korean Skrull society. Yay!
Yeah.
So I mean,
yeah, we knew this was coming. Yeah, it's
all about the packaging. It's the thing that I was most interested by was when those rumors started to swirl about Whedon taking on the character. Whedon said, I don't like my characters clean. I like my characters, especially my female characters, to be messy. And he gave, Ripley as an example and some others. The way that Anna talked about the character and the way that Bree talks about the character in the set visit is, or the, spread... it's a messy character. She's flawed. She's superhuman, but she's also flawed. She's also very human. She's super, but she's also very human. Which I thought was an interesting thing, considering that the guy who, outside of what is the current culture that we are in now, before, would probably have been the guy to do this.
Yeah. I don't know why he said that, because I've always thought of Carol as a flawed character, but, to each his own.
Indeed. And I'm glad that Kevin's out there making the rounds and doing all these kinds of things. I think if I'm him, I don't want to touch any kind of media until I get on the press tour for this, because A, I'm right down there in Atlanta right now finishing up reshoots. Collider puts out a very confusing article that makes no sense to me. But, like, he doesn't want to be in front of cameras right now. None of them want to be in front of cameras right now. Because the first thing that they're going to get asked about is James mm-hmm. and the Guardian situation. And that's just not going to work out well for anyone.
No.
Talking about that right now.
No, they got to put some time and space between it. So, yeah, you put this out now. We get a trailer for this. Eventually, in the next 2 months, we'll find out some more Avenger stuff. And yeah.
Explain to me what the Collider article was about.
Which one?
The one about that can announce that they were doing the reshoots. Because it's very confusing the way that it's worded. I read it and I'm like, okay, well, this is a non-story. The way they worded it was they are finishing principal photography for Avengers 4, mm-hmm. but they are also doing reshoots. And, like, that's kind of a crazy thing. The closest thing I can compare it to is what Liv Tyler and Viggo Mortensen have all talked about the processes, and Kate Blanchett, they've all talked about the processes for the Lord of the Rings movies. They all said, yes, we shot bits and pieces of Two Towers and Return of the King. We had a lot of footage for both those movies, but the studio was, you know, the budget was ballooning, the studio was concerned about whether or not one would work, so we really just shot the complete Fellowship of the Ring, and he went to post and edited and did the special effects for Fellowship. And then when Fellowship hit and became a worldwide phenomenon, they gave him more money. We went back every spring for two more years to do reshoots for Two Towers and Return of the King and essentially do both principal photography.
And
well, it was called principal. It was called reshoots or additional photography, but it was really principal photography.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have enough to finish what they had. The Russos have never given me that impression with 3 and 4. They've given me the impression that they shot 3 whole and 4 whole, and then they were going to come back for 2 months of reshoots when everybody's schedule could work out to basically put the, you know, they were going to look at the dailies, they were going to figure out what they needed, they were going to come back in these 2 months, get it done, and then go into the editing bay and not leave until February. That's basically the impression I was left with. The Collider article's like, yeah, they don't even really have the ending set yet. Like, they're still handing out fake scripts. They've still shot 500 different things. Like, they haven't really shot the true ending to the Marvel Cinematic Universe yet because they haven't finished principal photography. Now they're going to finish principal photography and do reshoots. And it's like, that makes it sound like an even bigger, like...
So, I think the Lord of the Rings analogy is probably the best one. If I had to guess, because I don't know if anybody's ever asked them, like, the press.
Yeah, and the wording of the article was just confusing. It's like, okay, so is this news or is this not news? I mean, what are you trying to tell me here? The biggest thing I'm taking away from this is that they haven't shot the official ending. Well, you don't know that they haven't shot the official ending. They may have shot the official ending, but they're going to go back in and they're going to retool with some things.
Yeah.
I mean...
So... Yeah, I don't know if anybody's ever asked them during the press for Infinity War, like, are you completely done with 4? If I had to guess, they're probably more or less done with 4, but there are probably things they need to go in and actually shoot and then go back and reshoot some other scenes. I would think that's the case. It's just how much, like, original stuff do they have to shoot? I would guess it's not much. I wouldn't be surprised if the ending was one of the things they had to shoot just to gauge how everything went before. Like, they have a clear plan going into it, but, you know, they've got all this information from Infinity War and hell, for that matter, Black Panther, because I was listening to the commentary and they're like, we tested this movie the first time, when we tested before, and it was like, we get to Wakanda and everybody was like, yeah, whatever. And then we tested after Black Panther, and then the place blows up. So, do they retool stuff for the ending from that? I don't imagine it'll be, like, anything drastic. But do they make little tweaks here and there for the ending?
Well, you've also got the situation now with the Guardians where, like, whoever you want to leave dead, you can leave dead.
Yeah, which Dave has said, because, you know, Dave has been talking a whole lot about this. He's like, you know, he shot most of everything for Avengers 4. I think he did mention reshoots, but he's like, yeah, I don't know if we're going to end up alive or dead. Don't know now. They can do whatever they want now. That would be a way to get out of this whole Guardians 3 thing. Would be like, you know what? Kill them all. We need stakes. There's your stakes. Who knows? I doubt they do that, but...
Just the wording was really curious, and it was like, it seemed kind of clickbaity to me, and just seemed kind of like the design was to say that they haven't finished filming the ending, and we don't really know. But the Russos on the press tour for Infinity War kept saying, "You a movie has three parts. There's the movie that you write, there's the movie that you shoot, and there's the movie that you edit." And they said, "Well, we've shot." You know, they didn't give a percentage of it, but they said, "We've shot a film. Now we've written a film. Now we've shot a film. Now we got to edit the film and figure out what that thing is as a whole, as its own entity." And, you know, until then, we're just going to be stuck with people on the internet going down the rabbit holes of, you know, time travel and how are you going to do this and all of this kind of thing.
Yeah, all the theories are nice and stuff, but I've just been like, you know what? Done. I'm not making a theory. I don't care. I'll just see it.
I'm going off what the Russo says about the barf technology. That way you can emotionally project, but you don't actually travel back in time.
Like, everybody forgets that. Like, they've said this several times. Like, the stuff we used in Civil War is coming back. Particularly when they had the shots of Cap from Avengers come back. They're like, you know, maybe we just used some stuff we used in Civil War. And anytime anybody has a theory, nobody says that. And I'm like, but them, they told you they're going to use this. All right, okay, whatever.
There's a 5-minute set piece at the beginning of Civil War that was put into place for a very particular reason. That's the exact quote.
You can't just go. Just have you not seen Civil War? Just go watch it again. It had 5 minutes. Just, you know, start the clock. See when it happens.
Indeed. So Chad, I am now prepared to dance on the grave of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, as I revel in the and take great joy in all of their sadness and their misdeeds. Would you like to tell the fine folks of our podcast why I'm rejoicing and dancing on the grave of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences?
All right, last time we met, the Academy had just announced that they were going to add a category for a thinly defined category of popular movie.
And achievement in popular art, yeah, or achievement in popular culture.
Something like that. So everybody rightly took this as, oh, so they're just going to give us they're going to placate people that like popular movies with an Oscar. So your superhero movies and things like that can get nominated and people can shut up. And Twitter rightly lit them on fire. At that point, when we met, you went on probably about a 10-minute rant about the Academy and all their misgivings with this. So we fast forward to like late last week. The Academy was like, you know, that award we announced, let's just forget about that right now. We're just going to walk away
from it. Needs further study.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have thought you'd have done that before we announced the award, but hey, you know, whatever. So they went back on this award, and now here we are.
So that's not the interesting part of this story for me. The interesting part of this story for me, anyway, is basically the head of the Academy, the president of the Academy, and the head of the Board of Governors give an interview to Hollywood Reporter, in which they basically say, A, we did not anticipate the backlash. B, here were our reasons for why we thought that this was a good idea. And they present some sound defenses of what they were trying to do. And then they say, but anyway, we're going to shelve it because of the backlash. If you have enough gagunzas to put this out there, you should have had a public relations defense strategy laid out and ready so that when the backlash happened, you could refute it with, yes, I understand where you're coming from, but A, B, C, D. Which is what they do in the interview. A, B, C, D. This is why we thought this was a good idea. It wasn't because of ratings. It wasn't because ABC told us to. It wasn't because we were looking to become relevant. We legitimately just were in a corner where we know that these films are art, and we want to include a recognition of them, but we didn't know how to do it. And this was the way that we came about coming to the conclusion of how to include those films. We've taken great steps with the Academy, with the diversification of the body, that we are hopeful that there will be a more inclusive environment for more films and more different kinds of films for the Best Picture race due to the different kinds of people who are voting. But, like, these things are art. They deserve to be looked at and recognized as art, but we didn't know how to do that without completely changing the framework of our Best Picture award. And so this was where we landed after months. They said literally months. They said they started the day after the Academy Awards in March. They've been meeting for months. There was a subcommittee that was convened for the Academy to come up with and study and look at this idea. This was the recommendation. The recommendation did not come with the criteria, so they formed another committee to work on the criteria, and they were in the middle of doing that when the announcement came, and then the backlash happens, and then you get caught with your pants down. And so I could have gotten behind the defense that they laid out. They didn't defend it. They stayed quiet, and they let the storm rage until they couldn't stand it anymore. And they didn't apparently do any smoothing of the edges with any of the branches, so it's not like they went to the set designers branch or the makeup and hairstyling branch or the composers branch and said, hey, this thing's coming, we're making some changes to the telecast, we're gonna cut down on speeches, and we're gonna introduce this popular art category. They didn't give any heads up to the full body, they didn't bring it before the full body for a vote. They just put the press release out there with the recommendation. And so they got the backlash, and they didn't back it up, and they didn't defend it. And so that's on them. Mm-hmm. If you have an adequate defense and you choose not to defend it,
That's you.
The moment, and even if you got caught and you were like, we don't expect this to be a thing. Even if you get caught, the moment you see Twitter ablaze, you go full throat with your defense. You put out statements at that point, and you say, here's our reasoning, here's our logic, here's what we did, here's how we got here. Not, never mind, we're not going to do this because everybody's upset about it, but this is why we wanted to do it, this was how we thought we were going to do it. You know, it was a valid idea. You know, one of the head of the governor's body says, you know, look, man, I would much rather be hunkered down in some room watching a silent film from the 1920s than go into the theater to watch the latest Marvel movie. So if I can get behind this, y'all should have been able to as well. Mm. And, like, where was that kind of bravado and gusto in your defense of this proposition? Because the idea might have had more legs and gained a little bit more popular support if you'd have defended it this way. Instead, you just let the internet run ablaze and you got, you know, creamed. So, I mean...
So, I think part of it is that I don't think they think that that the internet buy anything that they sell. Because up until this point, kind of no matter what they do, the internet's like, nah, it's not good enough.
But why, at this point, if you know... Okay, here's the thing. At this point, if you're putting this out there and you do it, why come back 2 hours later and say, no, we didn't do this, ABC told us to do this. And both the president and the president of the Board of Governors and the CEO or the director of the Academy both come out and say, ABC didn't ask us to do this. We had started to study the issue on our own. It had nothing to do with ad sales. It had nothing to do with the TV contract. It had nothing to do with ratings. We recognized we had a problem. We wanted to try and fix it. Just the same way we recognized we had a problem with diversity, we wanted to fix it. And so, you know, that's what happened. But that's my problem. Internally, it's... You didn't have... You live in Baton Rouge. You see LSU operate. You love Michael Bonnet. Great guy. LSU has had the worst public relations in the athletic department ever in the last 3 years. And it's still ongoing to a certain extent. They don't always have a clear and concise plan for how to attack things. You know, Joe wants to get the, you know, the athletic director wants to fire the football coach and bring this coach in. But instead of that being a subtle thing that's known all throughout the city and blasted on the airwaves for 6 weeks, and then when things get complicated and changed, and the athletic director can't do what he wants to do, then they come back and they keep the coach, but they can't get their story straight about when they made the decision to keep the coach, and how the coach was told, and why what the thought process was in the decision-making to keep the coach. And then, you know, 10 months later, you actually fire the coach on the plane ride home, and, you know, you have a press conference, and you name an interim athletic director, and then you start a coaching search. But you have all kinds of bad PR with a coaching search. And you end up hiring a guy who wasn't going to, you know, turn down the job if you'd offered him $30 to be the coach. And you lose the PR war on that. And then the emails come out because they're a public institution and the athletic director's using a publicly university-paid phone. Just in a publicly university-paid email. And so those come out. And you don't know how to handle the press with that. You don't know how to get ahead of the narrative. They can't... I love Michael Bonnet and those guys to death. They've been there for... All those SIDs have been there for 40 years or 35 years or more. They are absolutely brilliant at what they do. But they can never stay ahead of a story. They can never see that bad word is coming or see it is on Twitter and respond to it in an appropriate way. The Academy didn't do it either. They let this recommendation go out there. No one stopped and said, look, they've made this recommendation. We cannot make this public until we have all of the details. Ironed out, nailed down. I don't care if it means we can't have this for this particular ceremony. We are going to get killed if we just throw this out there and then we don't have a criteria for it. We just put out this vague description of a title and then nothing else. So let's not do that. No one said that. Once they put out the vague description of the title, no one said, hey, you actually think this? You actually believe this? Let's put out a press release with our statement. And let's get the heads of every division of the branch of the Academy to sign it and say, this is why we're doing this and this is what we stand behind. Instead, they saw the negative publicity and they never got in front of it. They let it affect them, and then after it affected them and changed what they were going to do, then they offer their defense. Then they offer their rationale. Then they try to put their positive spin on it. And that's my problem. I don't care if you didn't think that people were going to accept it or not. You needed to play ahead, because it's easier in public relations to play from ahead and spin from ahead and change the situation to people's perception of what's going on to your favor if you're ahead of the story. If you're in behind and you're playing catch-up and you're perpetually playing catch-up, you're never going to be in a position of strength.
Well, to that I will say, so the Academy strikes me as a place of many different factions. And when you have splinter groups within one, if there's not a strong voice or if it's not a voice that all of them respect, they just kind of run wild. And then you get things like this. I don't know much about the Academy president. Now I know it is a woman, right?
No.
No, it's a guy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but he's new.
Well, he just got voted to another term.
So...
with overwhelming majority.
Well, that would still just mean that they probably, I mean, they put him up there because it probably means that most of them can get him to do what they want. It doesn't seem like he's like whipping them into shape, because you would at least have one of the positive things that you said probably would have come. Chief among them would be, let's not say this until we get all our ducks in a row. But the fact that it dropped when it did, and then all the things that happened after that, and none of the things to like spin this into a positive manner, and it ends up with them having to tuck their tails and run away. You know, it starts with the top. So I know there's fissures in the Academy, because the Academy's trying to change a lot of stuff, and people are resistant to change, especially old people. And the Academy's a bunch of old people, and they're basically trying to get them out. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of resistance to a lot of the stuff that happens, and you're going to get stuff like this until there's stronger leadership that comes in there, or that this guy just puts his foot down and be like, alright, I know y'all had it before, but this is my way, the highway, we got to get this stuff together. You'll probably end up with more things that make the Academy look bad.
It's baffling when you have a good relationship with the press that you ever get behind in a PR war. Especially in this city, but like even in Hollywood, like you have reporters who are friendly in the trades to you and to your cause. How you can't get a heads up that a negative story is coming and get ahead of it, like that Academy member who resigned and wrote that long piece about y'all are wasting money on this museum, the museum's way over budget, y'all are gonna cause the entire system to collapse. Like, that was written and submitted to the Hollywood Reporter. You don't have enough friends over there to know that that's coming and then have a rebuttal in place for it. I mean, you see that there's, you know, all kinds of leaks about your coach's job possibly being in trouble as early as October, and yet you never call somebody up and say, hey, where's this coming from? Is it in here, or is it TAF? You know, who's saying these kinds of things? Or having a reporter say, hey, I've got this story. Before I run it, would you like to comment? Which gives you a heads up that they're going to print the story anyway, so you can have your response ready. And that's the part that you know, with a legacy, a legacy company or a legacy group like the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, not to have a coherent public relations strategy. And the thing is that they did a brilliant job with the rollout of the diversity initiative. I mean, that was phased. It was over the course of years. It was, you know, they had the complaints about ageism, and they had a response ready for it. Like, they rolled that out perfectly. They didn't do this perfectly. And you know, they're not really handling the museum perfectly either. So
that was a different person, though, right?
Yeah.
See? There we go.
So, but anyway, I mean, I'm happy that they have reconsidered and that they're not going to give a kiddie Oscar. But I'm interested to see if Marvel and Disney are going to put a full-throated Best Picture campaign together for Black Panther, which will include Best Supporting Actor nomination for Michael B. Jordan, then if it can succeed. I mean, Logan and Wonder Woman supposedly had huge ad buys for Academy season last year, got nothing. So
I would imagine that they will. I don't expect much to come of it, but I mean, why not? It seems to be your best chance. Why not do it? See what happens. I mean, I know it's gonna at least compete for like, you know, some technical awards, particularly like the costume design and stuff like that. But I don't see a Best Picture nod in this future, but
If anybody got the money to try.
Yeah. It's Daddy Piggy Bank, Mr. Moss over there.
And this is your reminder that Solo will be on DVD this week.
Oh, it's this week?
Yeah.
I know it's coming soon. I just didn't know when. Mm-hmm.
This is your reminder that's a movie
The only reason I know is because I saw on Twitter somebody posted, "No fans, you don't get to be upset that they're dropping spoiler clips for Solo when you didn't even go see it."
That was Jim.
That was Jim? Okay. I knew it. That makes sense.
So, what is the next thing that we're really looking forward to? I mean,
what's the next thing? What's the thing we're looking forward to? Because there's two different things.
The next thing is Venom.
Yeah.
A lot of positive reaction for A Star Is Born. A lot of positive reaction for Lady Gaga's performance. A lot of controversy over First Man. Kind of an overblown thing. It doesn't seem like it's a... the best review that I've seen has pretty much been... It's not a Neil Armstrong biopic. It's more a We Seven with a focus on the intensity and the danger of the mission. And something that, you know, Apollo 13 and the other astronaut movie from back in the day. The right stuff. They didn't focus on as much on the intense danger of imminent doom, that these guys could literally die. Mm. And it seems that, you know, Chazelle is pretty fascinated with that and uses his camera very wisely and very up close, creates a sense of up close, tense emotions throughout the film. The choosing not to do the flag, the planting of the flag, is not a big deal to me, but it's going to be a huge artistic controversy.
Of course.
And, you know, that's going to be interesting. Shane Black's Predator is getting killed. McQueen's movie about the widows is being very well received. The Hate U Give is being very well received as being nuanced storytelling that will appeal to a mass audience, which is good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Because quite frankly, watching that trailer, it feels like a movie that's going to make you uncomfortable. Kind of a Black Klansman type deal, where it's like, you know, we are going to talk about these things, and we're going to talk about these things in a very blunt way that are going to make you think critically about the situation and also form your own opinion and maybe even challenge your own opinion on these subject matters. So I was good to see that they did that while still being tactful, which is good. Overall, Oscar season's rounding in shape. And, you know, now they don't have to worry about changing their marketing strategies to meet with... you know, the Popular Culture Award.
Yeah. yeah.
I mean, we're in the middle of a dead zone right now.
It is pretty dead.
We're in the middle of a dead zone right now. I mean, and we probably will be till we hit November. November and December are going to be ramped up, but, you know, September and October are pretty dry.
I mean, we have the aforementioned Venom, and then A Star Is Born the same day, and Halloween comes out at some point.
Halloween weekend, yeah.
Which, you know, I've heard that...
It debuted at TIFF to rave reviews. But that's nothing surprising considering everything that we've heard about this film for the last year, is that Danny McBride and then got this really right, and then brought Carpenter back in and got his input on a lot of it, so it kind of felt like a legitimate sequel instead of, you know, something like Halloween H2O or Resurrection or Zombies 2 Halloween movies that just kind of feel like, you know, hauled out shells that are just meant to make money off the trademark. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's good for people that like that kind of thing. I'm never going to see it. So.
You know, the Nun having good success this weekend is also
that's right. Yeah. And WB's had the number one movie for like
a month straight.
Yeah.
Between Crazy Rich Asians, The Meg, and now the Nun. Yeah.
Which.
And it's also for it being the James Wan business is very beneficial for all. Which is hopeful for our good friends at DC.
They still gotta move their date up. Bumblebee's not playing around. They gotta move their date.
You know what's surprising, Chad, is how crowded that December 19 field is, and nothing's moving for Star Wars.
And
I don't know if that's a reaction to what happened with Solo, or if it's just no one has any place to go, but like, December of 19, not playing around.
What's there besides the Jumanji thing?
A bunch of other stuff. There's a whole list. So.
They got time. They're going to scatter.
We'll see. All right. Well, that'll about do it for this week's episode. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. I am at BCW Tiger Fan.
At the Mets Theory.
Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.